welcome to episode 64 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, as always, is my co-host, RJ Anderson of CBS Sports. RJ, welcome back to the show. I'm so glad that we can get back together and talk about the many, many moves of the first couple of weeks of June.
Absolutely. Always one of the highlights of my week, or at this point, every other week.
Yeah, I think we'll be rolling a little bit more frequently now that we're getting into, we're seeing some trades getting made. We're getting into the heart of the summer, the All-Star break, and then eventually the trade deadline. So I think we'll be able to connect a little bit more frequently going forward because we have got actual exciting, interesting trades to talk about, or at least one.
Don't threaten me like that, Brian. But we do have one interesting trade to talk about, as earlier this week, the Kansas City Royals and Washington Nationals kind of kicked off what we think of as the trade season. Kelvin Herrera is heading to D.C. in exchange for Blake Perkins, Kelvin Gutierrez, and Johannes Morel. So, Brian, I guess I will start by asking you, what did you think of this deal for the Nationals?
Well, for the Nationals, I think it's great. I mean, my thought is that Herrera is one of the top relief pitchers that was going to be available this offseason. And we'll talk a little bit, or this deadline season. And we'll talk a little bit in a little bit about how now might be the right time to be aggressive in trying to get some relief help, because it seems like a lot of the other relief arms that may be out on the open market this deadline season starting to get injured, maybe might have some effectiveness issues going forward. So I really like this move for the Nationals. I think this is a smart move for a team that didn't have a lot of depth in their bullpen. I really like Doolittle, but you know, Brandon Kinsler isn't an elite back-of-the-bullpen arm, and Herrera really is. And so I think that he's a really good addition to this team. He's not exactly the strikeout ace that he was prior to his career, but he's always been kind of up and down on the strikeouts. And despite that, he always remains pretty steady in terms of DRA, ERA. I mean, obviously this year his ERA is ridiculous, and that doesn't reflect his true talent level, but he's a good and very consistent pitcher, and I really like this addition for the Nationals. I think some of the criticism is of the relatively meager return that the Royals are getting back. I don't know, how do you kind of feel about the way that the Royals are getting back some, what some might consider quantity over quality for the return?
Yeah, I'm not usually a fan of that approach, and in this case, that does seem to be what the Royals did, although I do wonder how much of this is just, you know, that this is the market for relief pitchers, and Herrera is a good relief pitcher. I mean, I think you actually undersold him a little bit, because I believe he's got, like, an absurd strikeout-to-walk ratio right now, because he's not walking anyone. Right. And, you know, you watch him pitch, and he's got that, you know, upper 90s fastball that has some sink to it. He's got, you know, two swing-and-miss secondary offerings, and I think he's good. And, you know, you can plug him in as a closer, and I don't think anyone's going to say, oh, you're, you know, using him out of his role or whatever. And that, in that sense, you know, he's certainly qualified to be the eighth inning guy or the seventh inning guy if they want to use him as a rover or whatever. But, yeah, the Royals' return didn't seem that inspiring to me. I believe they got, like, the 10th and 11th prospects in the national system, which is not that deep, despite, you know, Juan Soto's emergence. No one really had the Nationals as a top system entering the year. And, of course, you know, that's without talking about Victor Robles, who's got hurt. But the point is, yeah, it doesn't seem like a great return, and maybe you credit that to the market for relievers, but you would think that acting, you know, 6 weeks ahead of a deadline would help improve the return, and instead – kind of looks like they didn't really, you know, get much different than what they could have gotten in 6 weeks' time. So, you know, there's certainly the injury aspect to consider. But, yeah, it does seem disappointing. And I do like the deal for the Nationals, you know, just to kind of echo your sentiment. And it's kind of funny how they have, like, this – they have, what, five guys now who have double-digit saves for their career. That's, you know, Doolittle, Madsen, Kinsler, Herrera, and of course Sean Kelly, who everyone thinks of when they think of that group. And then they have Justin Miller, who I just wrote about. And Justin Miller is a 31-year-old journeyman who his first 43 batters faced struck out 22 of them, walked zero, and allowed one home run. So that's pretty fun, even if it's not going to last. So I don't know, the Nationals bullpen kind of looks like it could be a strength, even if it's not quite on the level with some of these other contenders' bullpens. You know, they do have a chance, though, for a pretty devastating 1-2 punch with Herrera and Doolittle. Once you get late into games.
And I definitely think that it's smart for the Nationals to be aggressive, because the Braves and the Phillies don't really seem to be going away. And I know that there's some chance that they're going to regress a little bit as the season goes on, but the Braves have been excellent. And the Nationals have lost, well, we'll talk a little bit about it. They've lost Steven Strasburg. They haven't gotten all the performance they would have liked to have gotten with some of their starting pitchers, Max Scherzer aside. So I think that it makes a lot of sense for them to go out and try to get somebody early, because it's certainly not a given that the second or that a wild card team is going to come out of the National League East, and getting that top spot in the East is going to be really, really important to them going forward. And they have a little bit more of a fight for it than I think people might have expected.
I agree with all that, but at the same time, you know, to be fair to the Nationals, part of this fight is because of their injuries. And, you know, there's only so much you can ding a team for having a number of injuries pop up, you know, maybe complaining on the training staff or whatever. And to be fair, again, you know, the Nationals have kind of had a history of getting injured. So maybe it's the players, maybe it's something they're doing to the players. I don't really know. But another part of the race they're in is because the Braves and Phillies both seem like they're a year ahead of schedule. At least they are to me. I thought the Braves would be around 500 this year, and I didn't think the Phillies were quite good enough to give the Nationals a legitimate scare, but hey, they're both in the race right now, and you know, anything can happen. We've got what, 3 months left, and you know, who knows? So yeah, I do agree with the Nationals.
It's
every right to go out there and be aggressive.
It's funny because I had it kind of flipped the other way. I thought the Phillies were going to be about a 500 team, and that the Braves were going to be worse than they were. And I've been proven very wrong about the Braves because of the emergence of a couple of their young players, and we can talk a little bit more about that a little bit later on, because one of those great young players got injured. So we can get to that in a little bit. But for now, maybe we want to switch topics a little bit to a team on the other side of the country and in the other league. I'd want to talk a little bit about Shohei Ohtani, the Los Angeles Angels, and the just tremendous bad luck that they've had recently in terms of putting, you know, literally a fifth of their roster on the DL in the span of about a week. Most importantly is the Shohei Ohtani injury. Ohtani's been, if not the best story in baseball for the first half of the season. You know, I don't really know of much of another contender for it. And then now, of course, suffering that UCL injury, it looks like he may not pitch until 2020, which is really unfortunate. It's bad for baseball. It's generally just about the worst possible injury I think we could have dealt with in baseball this year. Talk to me a little bit about Ohtani's injury. How it made you feel other than just disappointed, and where you kind of see the Angels going forward.
Well, I think disappointment is the right word, though, because, you know, he is arguably the funnest player in baseball to watch, either when he was in the batter's box or on the mound. And, you know, what he'd been able to do this season wasn't just live up to the hype, which, frankly, had seemed outsized, you know, entering the season. He actually found a way to, you know, exceed that hype, because he had like a 120 ERA plus and like a 130 OPS plus. And that is insane for anyone to do, let alone a guy who, you know, is literally in his first few months of living in the United States and has to adjust to a new league and, you know, a new way of doing things. So all the credit in the world to him. He's just an outstanding talent, and I hope he gets back sooner than later. But you're right, for the Angels, I mean, this was devastating, and it was devastating because, as you mentioned, you know, they had a few other injuries pop up, and what did we talk about with the Angels every time we talked about their competitive chances? It was whether or not their rotation could stay healthy, right?
Right.
And you look at their disabled list now, and who is on the disabled list for him? You have Alex Meyer, you have Shohei Ohtani, you have J.C. Ramirez, you have Garrett Richards, Matt Shoemaker, and Nick Trapiano. And a few of those are season-ending injuries. So you look at their present-day rotation, and it's Tyler Skaggs and Andrew Heaney, and then it's John Lamb, Jamie Barea, and Felix Pena. Now, yeah. I thought Felix Pena was an interesting middle relief prospect like 4 years ago. You have him in your rotation in 2018. You were probably definitely seriously in trouble, and same with John Lamb. So yeah, things are not looking good. And then you add in some of the other injuries they've had. I mean, Rene Rivera was, you know, in a timeshare catcher. He's hurt. Caleb Cowher, he's hurt. Zach Cozart, he's hurt and might be out for the year. Then you have Jeffrey Marte. And then we're not even talking about Kenyon Middleton being out all season. Jim Johnson's on the DL. Even Blake Woods out for the year. So, yeah, it's just, it's bad. And this team is, you know, rightfully slipping in the standings. And I think at this point, it's probably fair to say they're no longer a legitimate contender in the American League West because of these injuries, because of their backslide, and because of the Mariners' hot run. And that's disappointing because this team early on looked like it could be a pretty fun wrinkle in the postseason picture.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more on everything that you said. I'll point out briefly how wrong I was. I really did think that unless every single pitcher on the Angels staff got injured, that they would be a contender. And it turned out that basically every single pitcher on the Angels staff got injured, and they're not much of a contender. I really thought they were the leader for that second wild card, or maybe even the first wild card between the Yankees or the Red Sox. That ship does look like it sailed for this season, and it's incredible with Mike Trout and both Ohtani doing the same thing in being two of the most valuable players in baseball while they were playing, and now Trout is still by far the most valuable player in baseball, and it'll be a real shame if this turns out to be, quote, a wasted season with the Angels not being able to contend and Mike Trout being basically the second coming of, I don't know. I guess I would say Ted Williams at this point, although he's hitting for more power. I don't even know at this point what we want to call Mike Trout other than the first Mike Trout.
I want to add one thing too. You mentioned Ohtani and Trout. Let's not sleep on Andrelton Simmons and the season he's having. You're talking about an all-world defender. He's got an
Unbelievable.
OPS plus near 130. He's got like 15 more excuse me, 15 more walks than strikeouts. You can make a case they had three of the top, what, 10 to 15 players and maybe all of baseball. And yet, they're probably going to finish at 500 or below, depending on how things go the rest of the way. And that's just, it's amazing, right?
Right, and Simmons has already been injured too.
Yeah.
So, like, he just came back recently. The thing that Andrelton Simmons is doing now, where he's completely stopped striking out, is just unbelievable to me. He is, I swear, I don't think any player has improved in the way that Simmons has over the last couple of years, taking, one aspect of his game and really working to improve his approach, and to even further improve his bat to ball abilities. I mean, he's phenomenal. He's so much fun to watch. He is one of, if not the most aesthetically pleasing player to watch in baseball right now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of who I would put ahead of him.
Mike
Maybe
Trout and
Trout,
Shohei Ohtani, possibly, but that would be
maybe
about it.
Lindor as well, because Lindor is just—he's like a—I don't even know what to compare him to. I mean, when you watch him play shortstop, he's just so smooth and silky, and it's just like he's programmed to make these plays. Except he doesn't move like a robot; he moves like, I guess, a simulation. Except those don't even really look as smooth as he. I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying here, Brian. But yeah, your point is well taken. And again, like you said, Brett Simmons.
Lindor's Neo from the Matrix, and Simmons is I don't know, the
Don't set up a Mr. Anderson joke here.
Yeah,
Don't do it.
let's not do that. Let's move on
Yes.
instead. So yeah, well, let's go ahead and write off the Angels now, and I'll be interested to see how the team kind of adapts going forward. But it's one of those things that's a disappointment, but I there's other things to like about some other teams like the Mariners and their successes, so it's not a complete loss. So this episode of the DFA podcast is brought to you by Fielder's Choice Goods. We've just been talking about a lot of leather with Andrelton Simmons and Francisco Lindor. Let's talk about a different, slightly different kind of leather. Fielder's Choice Goods features beautiful hand-cut wallets made from vintage game-worn baseball gloves. They're a wonderful product, and we thank them very much for sponsoring our show. So, RJ, do you want to talk about a different team out west?
Yes, let's talk about one who we cannot write off, and that's the Arizona Diamondbacks. Obviously, they've had some struggles of their own in recent weeks, and yet they went out there and made what I consider a smart trade, acquiring John Jay from the Kansas City Royals in exchange for Elvis Luciano and Gabe Spire. And so, Brian, what do you think about this John Jay trade?
Well, I think Jay's been playing pretty well because that's what John Jay does every single year. He basically puts up roughly the same season every year. Lots of on base, lots of batting average, nothing in the way of power, and plays solid, if not super, defense in center field. I do think he's a really nice platoon bat for a team like the Diamondbacks. So I love this trade for the Diamondbacks, actually, especially considering like Spire is, a bullpen fill-in piece to me. He's not anything that's going to be a dynamic guy in the middle of the at the end of baseball games or something like that. So that really only leaves the other piece of the trade, which is Elvis Luciano, and he's still kind of an unknown. And the Diamondbacks need to supplement their roster with the AJ Pollock injury, everything else that's been going on for this team. So I really thought this was a smart move, and I think the Diamondbacks are helping to cement themselves and hold out against the Dodgers for the long haul in the West.
Yeah, and you know, Diamondbacks also have the Steven Souza injury, and they were getting nothing out of Chris Owings and out of Jared Dyson. And the way the Diamondbacks have built their roster, they basically had a bench of field-only types. And you're kind of still seeing that play out. You know, Marte hasn't hit as expected. Nick Ahmed is never going to hit. Daniel Descalso somehow has hit. I really don't know what to make of that. It feels like I'm in a different dimension right now. But, you know, they needed some offensive help, and Jay should give them that. And, you know, you look at their roster, most days they're running out maybe three guys who have an OPS plus of 100 or better, maybe four, depending on what John Ryan Murphy has done. And it's really hard to win games that way. So, yeah, you have to add a guy like Jay. And I agree, he's been underrated. I was surprised he didn't land with a contender as a fourth outfielder / platoon type, because you know, he's shown he can succeed in that role. And, you know, I'm glad he landed on the contender sooner than later, because he doesn't really deserve what was going on in Kansas City. And hopefully, you know, he can keep it going, and maybe he'll earn a contract with the contender this winter.
Yeah, with Pollock out, I really do kind of like the offense defense platoon that they can run out there with Jerod Dyson and Jay in center field. I think that's going to be a lot better and a lot more effective than just running Chris Owings out there. Even though Dyson's had such a terrible season with the bat, he's still a very effective defender and base runner. So I do kind of like that combination where you've got Jay for a little bit of offense and Dyson for a little bit of defense. And now that Paul Goldschmidt is hitting, you know, like Paul Goldschmidt again, I think that we're going to see a little bit of positive regression. I think Jake Lamb will start picking it up a little bit at some point. So I definitely like the move for the Diamondbacks. I'm not super worried about them. I think they're going to be in the thick of things with the Dodgers as far as this thing goes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, speaking of teams who are in the National League, not only in the National League wildcard race, but also in the race for the division, the Milwaukee Brewers went out there and made a trade. They sent G-Man Choi, a first baseman at the AAA level, to the Rays in exchange for Brad Miller, who is, and you know, add quotation marks here, a first baseman, and right now he is also at the AAA level. What do you think of this, I guess, challenge trade?
Yeah, I do. I do agree with you that it's kind of a challenge trade. I don't know if it's just because I'm so bought into the Brad Miller thing for years and years, but I kind of like it for the Brewers. Then again, I also liked it when the Brewers brought in Nick Franklin, and that was basically the same exact situation and the same exact failure that I expect the Brad Miller trade to be. I mean, it's this thing now where it's just this pipeline of former Mariners infielders to the Rays, and then the former Rays infielders to the Brewers, and they just don't seem to be all that good. The thing about this deal where I kind of like it is because the Brewers have done with their infield. They've built a very flexible infield, and I like that. And so if you're looking at Miller as like the 26th guy, the 27th guy, the sixth infielder as a backup option for this team, I think it's pretty nice to have that as kind of an option for a team like this. Should he be at any point even remotely displacing guys like Eric Thames or Jesus Aguilar or Ryan Braun? No, that would be stupid. But as a backup for when one of those guys gets injured, I don't mind it at all.
So, for starters, I would note that Matt Arnold used to be an executive with the Rays, and he seems to be, at least to be clear, he's with the Milwaukee Brewers now as an assistant GM. So he seems to perhaps have some sway here, and these seem to be guys that he liked from his days in Tampa Bay. So far as Miller himself, I will note that he has been in AAA, and you know what position he's played exclusively in AAA for the Brewers?
I would assume they're leaving him at first base, but
you would assume wrong, Brian, because the one infielder you did not mention, the one who has been pretty bad, even though I was a fan of him, is shortstop Orlando Arcia, and Brad Miller has been playing shortstop in the Brewers minor league system. Yeah, that's not going to work out well defensively, but if we can connect the dots here, I feel like between, you know, Tyler Saladino taking Arcia's job earlier in the season and now this Miller trade with him moving immediately back to shortstop, it seems more likely than not that Brad Miller is going to be the Brewers starting shortstop by July 1st, and that is a terrifying proposition if you're a Jesus Aguilar or anyone who has to try to catches, throws, or let's just put it this way. The Brewers pitching staff is going to hate Brad Miller.
Yeah, and they're not a pitching staff that can really they could use the help of a good defensive alignment behind them. So I don't feel really good about that, but the Brewers do need to get every possible advantage that they can if they're really that low on Arcia at this point. And I know Arcia has been bad this season, but that makes me nervous. I think they've got enough beef in the other parts of the lineup that they could support, you know, having Arcia's defense at least out there at short. But what do I know?
Right. Yeah, so we'll see on that front. And then just to quickly address the Choi aspect of this trade, he basically slots into Durham as Miller's replacement without having to be on the 25-man roster. He's hitting 302, 430, 477 this season in Triple-A with 35 walks, 37 strikeouts. You're wondering, what's the catch? Well, he's hit 5 home runs, and he's a first-base-only guy, so that's kind of the catch. And, you know, this would not be a DFA podcast if we didn't mention, Brian, that Mr. Choi is one of the baseball players to come out in the last 2 or 3 years claiming that he was visited by a ghost while staying in a baseball hotel. So he has a soft spot in my, I have a soft spot in my heart for Mr. Choi, and I hope that he does well. And who knows? Hopefully they did not put him up in the Benoit in St. Pete, because that's supposedly one of the most haunted hotels in baseball. So if he does get called up, hopefully he's like staying with a teammate or something, because we do not want him to have to experience that again.
No, absolutely not. It is rather appropriate that now he's playing for what I would consider one of the most haunted teams in Major League Baseball with the Rays. So,
speaking of haunted teams, the New York Mets released Adrian Gonzalez during our sabbatical. Excuse me. I can't talk today, folks. I'm just so, you know, choked up about this Gonzalez release. And Brian, I'm sure you are too, right?
Yeah, this was a move that needed to happen. The Mets made the right decision by letting Gonzalez go. He wasn't going to be a long-term fit for this team. He wasn't probably going to be a very good short-term fit for this team. But the Mets are still a tire fire. They're now playing Dominic Smith in left field. So that tells you pretty much everything you need to know about how this season is going in New York.
I agree with that. And let's shift to another veteran losing his job. Melky Cabrera was released by the Indians. If you didn't know Melky Cabrera was playing for the Indians, you probably weren't alone. At 58 at bats, he hit 207, 242, 293. Is this the last we'll ever see of the Melkman in the majors?
I don't know if it's the last we'll see. I have a feeling that at the start of next year, we'll be talking about him as a non-roster invitee with some potential for some team. But at the same time, his background probably doesn't make him, you know, the PED and the issues around that probably don't make him popular with every single front office out there. And his skills seem to have diminished to the point where he can still put the bat on the ball, but that's about it. So I think we're probably done with him as anything more than a cup of coffee, fifth outfielder, or something like that.
And while Melky is a former Indian, who won't be on their team any longer, there's a former Indian who perhaps could rejoin Cleveland in the coming weeks. That's Boone Logan, as the Brewers designated him for assignment. The Indians have been scooping up basically every available veteran reliever out there, whether it's George Contos, Oliver Perez, Mark Zepchinski. Logan only got 10 innings in Milwaukee, did not do much to impress them, but in the past, he seemed like a decent enough loogie, and it would not surprise me if Logan finds his way back to Cleveland. Is there anything you would add to that, Brian?
I was surprised that Milwaukee cut bait on Logan. I know that they could afford to do that because their bullpen has been a strength this year, and you know, you have Josh Hader in your bullpen. You probably don't feel like you need any other left-handed pitchers in your bullpen. But I was kind of surprised to see him let go, because I know he's been pitching poorly this season. He's been giving up a lot of home runs, and his control has completely gone away. I don't know if it's a case of the yips or what, but I do think a team's going to try to rehab him and possibly even at the major league level really soon. So, yeah, he'll sign on somewhere, whether it's the Indians or another team looking for a reliever that can supplement. You know, we just talked about the Mets. He'd be a good fit there, especially with whatever has happened to Jerry Blevins. I'm not quite sure. The White Sox could even use him as a rehab and trade candidate. So yeah, I definitely think he'll be back.
Yep, I have nothing more to add on Mr. Logan. Sorry, Boone. So another big move that we missed this week, or during our time off, was the Twins sending Miguel Sano all the way down to Single A. Usually in these cases, that means that he needs either an overhaul of the swing, or they want to humble him, or some combination thereof. Snow has been very bad this season. What do you make of this, Brian?
I'm shocked that he's been as bad as he's been. There are the off-the-field issues, very serious allegations against him that I think probably, at least in some way, may play a part in the fact that he was bumped all the way down to single A rather than to triple A. It wouldn't surprise me if they wanted to send him to an organization within the team where they can have more eyes on him, perhaps, or they can keep him more engaged, or, like you said, maybe even rework the swing. But I'm truly shocked that he's been as bad as he's been to start the season. And I think that if he didn't have the off-field issues and he didn't have the reputation about, you know, not necessarily having the best makeup beyond the very serious and damning off-the-field allegations, I wouldn't have expected them to drop him down to single A, and I might even have expected them to try to continue to work this out at the big league level. I don't expect to ever see him in a Twins uniform again, at least with the big club.
That makes sense. And I'll note that I mentioned the swing in part because Parker Hagman on Twitter had an interesting thread where he kind of showed that Snow was going around the ball rather than to the ball, and his swing had gotten maybe a little longer than you would like to see. And then Emma Bachelary at Sports Illustrated also had some interesting data on how Snow is struggling with inside pitches. So that combination suggests that, yep, you probably need to rework the swing a little bit. And I was actually going to ask, do you think Snow is a non-tender candidate? And you kind of answered that for me. Whether they release him in season or waive him and try to find another team to take him on, or if they'll wait till the winter and non-tender him, I do agree that we probably have seen the last, if not the last overall of Snow with the Twins, at least the last of his significant playing time, I guess, extended playing time, whatever you want to call it. So that's kind of wild to think, because a year ago he was an all-star, he was on way to the best season of his, well, the best full season of his career, and it looked like he could potentially be a middle of the order thumper for them for years to come. But you're right, he's really, you know, he's brought this upon himself with poor acts off the field and also just seemingly not doing what they want him to do in addition to producing at the big league level.
And I'm absolutely 100% certain that he will get plenty of opportunities with at least one more franchise before all is said and done, because he is only in his age 25 season. He just turned 25 relatively recently. He's got the type of pedigree and the type of raw power that means that he'll keep getting opportunities as long as he wants them, and then he'll be able to play in Korea for as long as he wants after that.
Yeah, that seems about right, unfortunately. So moving on to a couple of players of name value who have returned to the majors from what had been season derailing injuries. Daniel Murphy is back for the Nationals, and Zach Britton is back for the Orioles. I think we can agree that of the two, Murphy is likely to have a bigger impact on his team, but Britton could actually impact the trade deadline more because, well, the Orioles are horrible, and they're going to be looking to move basically anything with a pulse, let alone a pulse in an expiring contract. Britton supposedly was almost involved in the deal with the Astros last July that would have netted Baltimore Colin Moran, but the Orioles medical staff spiked that deal because of concerns about Moran and his concussions. In retrospect, that looks like a deal the Orioles should have made, but what do you think about a deal they could make if Britton comes back and shows that he's healthy and able to produce as potentially a high-leverage reliever again?
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? Is Zach Britton going to be able to flash being a high-level reliever again? It's an open question at this point, because he really hasn't done that since 2016. He's gotten some strikeouts since he's come back in those three games, but he's also been completely unable to find the plate, which is kind of concerning. I think he's going to come back and not be dominant Zach Britton, you know, with a half a run ERA, but I think he's going to be the type of guy that somebody wants to take a flyer on as a bullpen addition in the offseason or at the trade deadline. I keep saying that today. I don't know why. But at the deadline, I do think a team's going to be interested in him, and I do think he's going to be a good addition for that team. But boy, I don't think he's going to pull much of a trade return if this is all we see from Kelvin Herrera. I don't think there's going to be much coming back. And we saw a lot of these sort of deals at the last deadline where unless you are a top five reliever in all of baseball, I don't think you're bringing much back in return.
Yeah, and just one more note on Britton. So far, his sinker has checked in about 94 miles per hour. Last season, it was at 96, and the two seasons prior to that, 97. So it seems like he's lost, at least for the time being, some significant velocity, and I think that's probably going to cause teams even greater pause because Zach Britton without a highly effective sinker is not really the kind of reliever you want. I mean, the Dodgers basically have a poor man, Zach Britton, and Scott Alexander, and, you know, on any given day, he could be sent back down, it seems like. So, yeah, not exactly a great situation there. And Murphy, for the record, has not performed well since returning from a disabled list. And obviously, you know, you don't really know what he's going to do at this point. So, yeah, a lot going on there for those two impending free agents. And a lot going on in the injury world. A.J. Ramos is out for the season. Carson Smith is also out for the season. And then you have Nate Jones, who unfortunately can't seem to stay healthy himself. Those are three relievers. Which one matters the most?
So, obviously, since A.J. Ramos is with the Mets and Nate Jones is with the White Sox, the one whose actual performance for 2018 matters the most is Carson Smith. The Red Sox can always use another good relief pitcher. But what actually matters the most, I think, is that Ramos and Jones were both probably going to be trade candidates at the deadline. And now they will not be. And this is going to further limit the pool of decent relief pitchers on non-contending teams where there's some, you know, ability to make some deals. So the supply is starting to get a little bit more limited. And so that makes things very interesting for me because I really think that Ramos was probably, I don't know, he or Familia was going to be the most tradable of the Mets relievers in terms of guys who are about to run out of contract and, who are at least have some experience closing games. Jones is fantastic when he's healthy. I really like him as a reliever, but he can't stay healthy, just like you said. So I think this really is going to start to, we're going to start to see some of the dominoes fall into place with relievers moving at the deadline. I expect to see a lot of trades for closer and closer quality guys at the deadline. I just, maybe this will drive up the prices a little bit for quality relievers, although, you know, we saw with the Herrera trade, they're just not bringing all that much back in return these days.
Yeah, and as such, you almost wonder if some of these teams will try to trade the long-term relief pieces. For instance, Brad Hand, he has that extension, and, you know, the Padres may not want to trade him, but they may have to dip into the market and see if they can, you know, get a heck of a deal in return for him because he's one of the few impact level relievers who could be available. And I also add this, with that in mind, how bad does that Alex Colomay trade look? Because, you know, he's a guy who has years of control left. He had proven that he can pitch in high leverage situations, and they basically gave him away to get rid of Denard Sands' contract. So, boy, that looks brutal. It looked brutal at the time. It looks brutal in retrospect as well, especially when you consider the market's likely outlook for the next 6 weeks.
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly looks brutal for the race. It looks awesome for the Mariners because the Mariners, they spent whatever they could afford to spend, and they got a quality relief pitcher and they got a quality outfielder out of the deal. So, I mean, you got to feel good about that if you're the Mariners from that perspective as well. But yeah, it'll be really interesting to see. The Padres have a couple of interesting relievers who seem to be able to be staying healthy in addition to Hand, who you mentioned. My dude Craig Stammen has somehow turned into a super high quality reliever, and then Adam Simber, who emerged out of nowhere to be a solid contributor, I think. Oh, and then there's also Kirby Yates, who recently got a write-up over at Fangraphs by Jeff Sullivan. So there's like four good trade options for relievers for the Padres. I think they'll wind up being very
busy.
Very much in demand once we get closer to the deadline.
I agree with that. And one of the teams who might be looking for relief help is the Philadelphia Phillies. And they got some bad news as J.P. Crawford will be out 6 to 8 weeks with a broken hand. Crawford really hasn't played that well this season when you look at his overall numbers. And neither has Scott Kingery, actually, even though he was signed to that big extension before the season. What do you make of the Phillies situation here with these younger infielders who haven't necessarily developed into productive big league hitters yet? And do you think that the Phillies might go out on the trade market and try to acquire someone like, say, Mike Moustakas, or, you know, perhaps Manny Machado, you know, just throwing some names out there? Do you think the Phillies are realistically capable, and should they pursue those guys as the deadline nears?
So here's what I have to think about that. I think that we were going to hear lots and lots of Manny Machado to the Phillies rumors if this didn't happen. I think that it's starting to make more sense because Crawford keeps losing this development time. Kingery is not probably a shortstop long term, I think. I think he's more suited to being a second baseman, being a third baseman, or being this super utility player. I do think he's going to turn it around this year and be a more effective overall player going forward. But with Crawford, he, like you said, he wasn't playing particularly well before the injury. I still think he's got potential to be a regular, but the Phillies are one of the few teams that can afford the prospect cost for a Machado, and it's the type of move that I think would make a lot of sense for them, despite the upcoming free agency. I think they could figure out a way to make that work if they could get a commitment for him to sign with the team. So I think we're going to hear about that a lot this year. I don't know if, and possibly in the offseason, even if Machado is traded to another team and then elects to become a free agent. So I think this is a situation that the Phillies are going to go out and get another middle infielder at some point, whether it's Machado or whether it's somebody else. I'll be interested to see, because I'm not convinced anymore that the Phillies are all in on J.P. Crawford.
Yeah, and I'm not convinced that they should be all in on Mikel Franco, which is why I threw Moustakas out there.
Mikel Franco, I don't know why they keep giving him plate appearances. It just does. I know they don't have a lot of better options right now, but it doesn't seem like this is a good way to go.
I agree with that. And speaking of bad ways to go, San Francisco Giants lost two players in recent weeks. Third baseman Evan Longoria is out 6-8 with a broken finger. And more recently, closer Hunter Strickland is out at least a month, perhaps two, after breaking his hand in a, let's say, post-blown save celebration, so to speak, whatever you want to phrase that as. And Hunter Strickland, man, he's got this reputation for being kind of a hothead because of the Bryce Harper incident from a couple of years ago. Oh, I guess it was last year. Why am I saying a couple of years ago? And also now this with Lewis Brinson, and this is just another bad break, well, a pair of bad breaks for a team that's seemingly had enough of those already this year with Madison Bumgarner, Johnny Cueto, and I can keep listing injuries here. The Giants, like all other National League West teams, have had plenty to pick through. So are you still a believer that the Giants can potentially make the postseason or at least hang around this National League West race, or are you at the point where you're kind of ready to throw in the towel on their year?
I'm ready to throw in the towel, but none of the other teams in the National League West have so covered themselves in glory that I think that the Giants are completely out of it just yet. But let's go back to the fact that, I mean, the Giants are starting to get some guys coming off the disabled list. You saw Brandon Belt came off the disabled list recently. Bumgarner may be starting to get his feet under him a little bit. There's going to be some time soon where they're going to get back some of these other players, like Crawford's on the paternity list right now. Hunter Pence is probably done, but Jeff Samardzija may be able to come back at some point. I think that they could still be an annoyance and kind of poke at the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers going forward. I just don't know, man. This lineup right now, I mean, say what you will, but Alan Hansen at shortstop and playing somewhat regularly, and Gorkys Hernandez playing in center field, it's not looking like a team that you really want to root to knock off the Dodgers or the Diamondbacks.
No, and, the player who I enjoy the most on the Giants right now is Reyes Moronta, who's having a fine, hey, you laugh, but he is having a fine season.
No. It's just if that's the player you enjoy the most, then there's some problems going on. Are we going to talk about Pablo Sandoval?
No, we're not going to talk about Pablo Sandoval. You know who we are going to talk about and who is arguably the most enjoyable player on his roster, or was. I say that because Jorge Soler, finally having his big breakout season,
I know.
He's hurt, and so he will miss, you know, some time recovering from, I believe it's a broken toe, right?
Yeah, it's a broken toe, yep.
Yep, and he's supposed to be out at least 6 weeks. That is a bummer because, boy, Royals fans have it rough. And, again, he was hitting 265, 354, 466 with 9 home runs. And there's just not a whole lot of excitement on that Royals team. It's basically Whit Merrifield, Mike Moustakas until he's traded. And that's it offensively. I guess you can maybe get up for Mondesi's return. But, you know, your mileage varies there. So, yeah, things are looking pretty grim in Kansas City, and I don't really know that there's a whole lot of positives to point to otherwise because, you know, this, like Brad Keller, I just want to make this point. Brad Keller has gotten some hype this year, and yes. I had not really watched the Royals that closely, and I went to Brad Keller's baseball reference page, and we're talking about a reliever here. Granted, he's a 22-year-old, but we're talking about a reliever who is striking out 5 per 9 as being one of the bright spots on a team. That's not a good sign at all, so...
Yeah.
Sorry, Kansas City fans.
The thing about Solaris, like, he's one of the few guys who isn't, who could be part of the next good Royals team. You know, Merrifield, maybe, but really Solaris is pretty much the only guy who is playing well and could be part of the next good Royals team. So it's easy to get excited for him. And it finally, you know, it feels like this is something that Royals fans have been waiting for a long time, ever since the Wade Davis trade, and Solaris had his fits and starts. But yeah, it's a bummer. Fortunately, it's not like this crazy injury that's going to keep him out forever. I think he'll be able to bounce back from it.
I agree with that. Although I will say again, as someone who used to prefer Jorge Soler to Kyle Schwarber, I was starting to feel confident enough to express that opinion again. And then this goes and happens. And I'm like, jeez. Speaking of other injuries that hopefully will not keep guys out for long, we have a trio of starting pitchers on good to great teams who are dealing with injury issues. So Carlos Carrasco is out with a right elbow contusion. Steven Strasburg is out with shoulder issues. And Mike Foltynewicz, who you would not have heard mentioned with Carrasco and Strasburg before the season, is dealing with a tight tricep. So, Brian, all these injuries are obviously meaningful. Which one is the most meaningful right now?
It's probably Mike Foltynewicz. And it seems so crazy to say that. He's had such a brilliant season this year. I've always kind of liked him. I've been very critical of the Braves' strategy of acquiring a lot of young players and their big trades that they made over the last 3 or 4 years. But I've always liked Foltynewicz, and I was really happy to see him have that breakout season this year. This injury right now is probably the least concerning of the three because right now they're basically saying if he has a side session this week that goes well, he'll start on Sunday. I get nervous when we talk about tricep injuries for pitchers, especially young guys. So I'm really hoping this isn't something that's going to lead to UCL issues or further injury because I like watching him pitch. I think he's going to have to be healthy for the Braves to continue to go after the National League East title. Obviously, Carrasco and Strasburg are more important pitchers in terms of they have more longevity. They're probably even still better than Foltynewicz, but they have more serious injuries. And I think that there's a way that this breaks right and Foltynewicz can help carry the Braves into maybe meaningful October baseball.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add on all that other than saying that the Evan Gaddis trade looks pretty good for both sides right now, but I do think that if Foltynewicz secures himself as, you know, a number three or better, that the Braves really won that deal in retrospect, even though, you know, the other parts of the deal didn't really work out for them, because where would Evan Gaddis be on this team? And, you know, where is Evan Gaddis on most teams? So,
exactly.
In retrospect, that looks like a pretty good deal for the Braves, and yeah, it's fun watching Foltynewicz. It's also been fun watching Sean Newcomb, but a little less so because Newcomb's wildness, I think he's a little bit more wild than Foltynewicz, and you know, it's a bit of a bummer when he's, let's say, not on his best behavior. Speaking of disappointments, you know, one of my ever favorite players to watch is Matt Chapman, the Oakland Athletics third baseman. Well, he is on the disabled list now because of a right hand contusion. And I think you can make the case, a pretty easy case, in fact, that Chapman was the A's best player. They're not really in contention like I was hoping, but that has more to do, I think, with the Mariners' hot run than the A's themselves. And now they're without their best player for a little bit. Where do you rank Chapman among the game's best third basemen? Do you think he's top five, top 10?
Ooh, that's tough. There's a lot of talent at third base, even with Machado, now slotting in more as a shortstop. I would say he's pro I would definitely say he's in the top 10. I have more trouble putting him in the top five, just because I think there are too many other names that jump out at me as definite guys I would rather have. Would you rather have Chapman or Alex Bregman?
You're asking me to pick between my children, Brian, because
I
I don't really
know.
like Bregman. I think, any other team, Bregman's probably not even playing third base.
Right, but I think today I would rather have Bregman.
I might go with Chapman because, well,
Really?
whatever. The point is, you can't go wrong either way. I mean, they're both
That.
high quality young players, and they're going to be around, hopefully, for the next decade, making all-star games and potentially winning awards and whatnot. So both very good, but I would agree, top 10 for sure. Top five, you have Bryant, you have Arenado, you have wow.
Do you still consider Jose Ramirez as a third baseman?
Yeah, probably, right? For
So.
this exercise, I think you could. So that's three right there. And I know I'm blanking on a very obvious one. Who is the
Well,
obvious one I'm blanking on, Robert?
I was going to say there's a couple of different ones who, depending on how you judge best, Josh Donaldson has fallen off, but he still should be in the conversation if he's not one of the best. The same thing with Anthony Rendon. Like, I
Yeah.
definitely think you have to consider them in that conversation, if not, jumping out. And then the way he's been playing recently, you probably have to put Miguel Andujar in there, at least from an offensive perspective. And then the guy who d shouldn't get all the credit in the world, but should get some of it, is Eduardo Escobar, who has been, I believe, the second or third best offensive third baseman in baseball this year.
Yeah, and we should probably mention Adrian Beltre as well because though he's old, he's still a very productive player, and he can still get it at third base. So,
And the man
just
with 14 home runs playing for the team that's possibly the most irrelevant team in baseball, Eugenio Suarez of the Reds, 14 homers. His triple slash line for the season is 296, 384, 563. That's basically the Josh Donaldson triple slash line.
yeah. So there's a lot of good third basemen is what we're learning here, and I still think Chapman's probably top 10. I don't know about top five, but I think you can make a case he will be top five in the next year or two. So,
Yeah, I think that's fair.
well, I'm glad we're in agreement on that because you know what's not fair? Miguel Cabrera missing the rest of the season. And it's funny when Beltre got to 3,000 hits and then Pujols got to 3,000 hits, we all pointed to Miguel Cabrera and Robinson Cano as the next two who are going to reach that plateau, and they probably still will, but boy, it has not been a good year for those two collectively. Cano obviously got injured and then got suspended for failing a performance-enhancing drug test over for homicide. And now Cabrera is out for the season because he ruptured a tendon in his left biceps. And this has, quietly been a good season for Cabrera, at least production-wise. It hasn't been quite up to his old seasons, but it's been much better than last year. And you had some reason to think, oh, he'll quietly have a well above average offensive season that just doesn't scrape the heavens like he used to. But now we're coming up on it's going to be basically two consecutive lost seasons for him for one reason or the other. Are we starting to get concerned about where this is heading?
Well, I think people were concerned about where this was heading 2 years ago. So I think that that's okay. The thing that concerns me is that though Cabrera was having a much better offensive season, he was hitting for he was his approach was he was walking the same amount that he was before. He had kind of adjusted his approach a little bit, I think, to be focusing more on getting on base than in 2017. His power really hadn't come back. He had only had three home runs in 38 games. That is the red flag to me. Now, I could see a world where the bicep injury is a blessing in disguise and it gets him off his feet and not trying to play every day for the rest of the season. And that kind of rest for his lower body may make him a more effective player next year. I think there's the possibility that that could come back and he could come back at the start of next season after his surgery and be in a physical position where he's rested enough to, start being a, I don't know, top 15 hitting first baseman again.
That seems fair to me. I hope that's the case. Obviously, we're talking about a guy who's probably on a Hall of Fame trajectory. So,
Whoa, 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 whoa. Wait, I think we have to talk about that.
you don't think he's on a Hall of Fame trajectory if he gets 3,000 hits?
No, I think he goes into
Really?
the Hall of Fame if he retires today.
Oh, fair. Okay, fair enough. I misread you completely on that one. I was
Yeah.
gonna say, I know we're harder on first base slash DH types, but
Yeah.
he's not. Yeah. Okay, fair enough. You know who won't be in the Hall of Fame though, Brian?
Yes, I know quite a few guys who won't be in the Hall of Fame, but hit me with one of them.
Yovani Gallardo. He is back in the majors once more, and I'm gonna guess that most people did not realize he'd already pitched in the majors this season before being brought up by the Rangers. He made three relief appearances earlier in the season for the Cincinnati Reds because, hey, if you're a former All-Star, they'll let you pitch no matter how long it's been. So with the Rangers, he is somehow in the rotation, and I want you to guess how old Yovani Gallardo is.
So I know what you're getting at here because I know Gallardo started his career at an extremely young age. So I know he's still younger than we kind of think he is. So I'm going to guess that he is 34.
You are wrong, although your reason was correct. He came up as a 21-year-old. He had his first 30-start season as a 23-year-old. Gallardo is currently in his age 32 season. He will not turn 33 until late February next year. So what I'm really saying here is, although Gallardo has not been an effective big league pitcher in years, and I mean he has not had an ERA plus over 100 since 2015, we might have 2 to 3 more seasons of Yovani Gallardo popping up on these let's call them
Yeah,
cellar dwellers. And
buddy.
yeah, so that's Yovani Gallardo's welcome message. He's pitched for the Rangers before, of course, in 2015. Then he went to Baltimore, Seattle, Cincinnati. He's back in Texas. Where do you think he lands next year if you had to just throw out a guess?
Well, it would probably be Texas. I'm saying he sticks around.
I was going to say Kansas City, but fair enough. And that's all we have to say about Yovani Gallardo because of, good taste, so to speak.
Can we talk briefly about the Rangers rotation and number two starter Austin Bebenstierks?
And he's only that though because of the weird world. Excuse me, I can't talk right now. I'm so worked up about this. The weird rules violation that they threw out there, right? I don't think he was supposed to start. It was supposed to be Yonder Molinas, or I think I just butchered that guy's name. I'm sorry, Yonder. But yeah, right? Because they sent him down because of some weird rules violation.
Yeah.
Mendez is something. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm super excited. It sounds like we're going to have the world's first hyphenated battery with Bebenstierks starting and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. I know a favorite of yours as a super utility player who's going to possibly get a chance to catch him. So it's something for everyone to look forward to, I feel like, in this Rangers disaster of a rotation.
Yeah, and they moved Matt Moore to the bullpen, and that's something we had talked about earlier in the year when we talked about would you rather have Matt Moore or Matt Harvey? Just get a doormat because you're basically getting the same effectiveness, whichever Matt you choose.
It's not good.
It's not good, and you know what else is not good? The A's brought up Franklin Barreto. We talked about the Josh Donaldson. Well, we talked about Josh Donaldson earlier, and of course, he was the top piece in that tournament. Well, I don't know. I guess you can consider him a top piece, right? Brett Lowry wasn't, like, he was considered the big league portion, but Barreto was kind of the dude, right?
Oh yeah, Barreto was definitely the dude in that trade. I totally think that's fair.
All right. Well, I thought so, but I just wanted to make sure my memory wasn't going haywire. And, so far in the majors, he has not played well. He has a career 46 OPS plus in about 32 games, so small sample and all, but he's also not really hitting well in AAA. Last year he hit 290, 339, 456. This year he's hit 236, 335, 441. Those aren't great numbers. And I guess the reason you hold on to hope here is because he is only 22 years old. He won't turn 23 until next February. He almost shares a birthday with Yovani Gallardo, by the way. Just throwing that out there. But are we about at the point where we're giving up on Barreto becoming what the A's might have hoped he would have when they acquired him in the Donaldson trade? Or are you going to hold out hope a little bit longer?
So here's the only reason that I would consider holding out hope a little bit longer is it's still possible that his power could come, I feel like. Last year in AAA, he hit 15 homers with the Athletics AAA club. in Sacramento. He's got to fix his approach somehow. He's got to do something to become a more complete hitter. It's easy to hit in the PCL, so getting 15 homers and 15 steals isn't as impressive as it looks, but I don't really see him as an everyday shortstop anymore, for sure, defensively. And I'm not sure he's an everyday middle infielder at all. So maybe he's a super utility guy. Maybe he's a guy that splits time in center and third and all these other places. But he doesn't look to me like he's a big league regular anymore, unless he has like this Jose Ramirez style power surge and he's able to really like kind of lock into that. But yeah, I kind of see him as a utility guy going forward.
I credit you for using Jose Ramirez instead of the more trendy, more timely Ozzie Albies power surge. So credit to you. I would have probably went with Albies, but hey, we're our own people, Brian, right?
But and he doesn't have the bat to ball skills Albies has, and
No.
I mean he doesn't have the bat to ball skills that Jose Ramirez has probably either. So I guess that's saying something, but.
Speaking of saying something, the New York Yankees brought up a heck of a name last week to fill in the rotation. I'm going to probably butcher this, but I'm going to give it a try anyway because this guy deserves that. They brought up Jonathan Loaisiga. Oh, excuse me. Loaisiga. Loaisiga? Am I saying that correctly? I don't think I am. I don't feel like I am. But they brought him up from the minors. He has a very interesting backstory, doesn't he?
Loaisiga, Jonathan
Loaisiga.
Loaisiga. He does have an interesting backstory. I just, for me, it just, I see this happen, and I am just consistently amazed and impressed by the Yankees player development staff. It seems like they are able to turn guys with, relatively low prospect pedigree into average or better major league regulars so regularly. That I have to tip my cap. I think that they are now in a player development place that's not crazy dissimilar from, what we always said about the Cardinals being able to turn, these kind of medium level guys without a whole lot of pedigree into regular big leaguers. And especially with their pitchers, they're able to bring up these guys and all of a sudden they develop like they're throwing 95 and they're throwing a slider in their bullpen. They're doing some phenomenal things right now, player development. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, and I think Brian Cashman, in terms of general managers, is either the best or maybe the second best. And I think he's also underrated because of, in part because of, the structure he has there and the developmental staff, analytics staff. They're just seemingly aces on all fronts. And yeah, this is a very interesting story within itself because he missed, originally he signed with the San Francisco Giants, then he missed time due to shoulder injuries, he was released. And all of a sudden, he popped back up once the Yankee scout saw him pitching, I believe it was the Mexican League. And from there, he's found his way to the majors within, what, 2 or 3 years. So that's really, really impressive. And
And he had an impressive debut in his first start. I
he
mean,
did.
he seems like the real deal. Good for them.
I have always said the Yankees don't have enough talent and they don't catch enough good breaks. So
Yeah.
good for those.
And with his nickname Johnny Lasagna, I mean, it's just too perfect for the Yankees. It fits so good.
It does fit so good. And you know what else fits so good? Calling up a prospect like Francisco Mejia because, you just, if you're the Indians, I guess you're trying anything at this point. And I do think this is probably one of the least discussed aspects of this team that they have Mejia right there because, you look at their roster and they haven't gotten much out of their outfield all season. And they were smart enough, I suppose, or, maybe not smart enough, but maybe just foresightful enough to say, you know what, we want to give Mejia some time in the outfield and we're giving him some time at third base in addition to what he does behind the plate because maybe he comes up and maybe he's an outfielder for us at first or a third baseman or what have you. And maybe we move him back behind the plate later on and you look at their current roster and, well, Yan Gomes is having a good season, surprisingly, and where they need help. They need help in the outfield. So if they had just kept Mejia behind the plate, he really wouldn't be a factor for them right now, or they'd be, scrambling to give him some more reps in the outfield or whatever. But because of that, because of the foresight and because of the cross training, it's conceivable that he is actually their big deadline addition in their lineup. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I'm a little confused because I'm not certain that he's back with the Major League Club again now. I'm not sure if he's going to be. It looks like they might have sent him back down. And honestly, I think that they need to get him some of the big league experience and use him as kind of this position that you were talking about, this kind of everyman playing, getting some reps at catcher, getting some reps in the outfield, getting some reps at third, because I think they're going to need him before the season's over. And yeah, I know that they're running on all cylinders with guys like Lindor and Ramirez, Kluber, but I really don't think Jason Kipnis is long for this team. I'm a little concerned about his staying power and if he's going to make it to the end of the season here. And that might mean Ramirez moves over to second, and they need somebody to spell at third. And Mejia's going to be a big part of this team over the next 5 years. So I would love to see him get some playing time, some really like legitimate playing time this year. Get him ready because he does so much so well.
Yeah.
And he's been doing well, but not great in AAA this year. It's not anywhere near his breakout season in 2017. And I'd like to see what he can do in terms of picking up big league spin.
Right, and I think that might be the issue here. They're not sure if he's ready for the majors because of his performance. Because he's sporting a sub 700 OPS right now in AAA. So maybe they just want to, break him in slowly or what have you. But
I
the thing
get
with Kipnis is he feels like he should be basically in the last year of his contract, and yet he's not. He's got a multi-year deal. I think he has like 2 or 3 seasons remaining. So do you really think they would release him, or do you think they would try to trade his contract, or what do you think is the most likely scenario there? Because you said that you didn't think he was long for this team.
I don't. I think that the Indians do not want to release him. I think that is the least likely option. But I think they'll either move him into a legitimate bench role, or more likely, I could see them making a bad contract for bad contract swap with another team. I think that's the most likely thing that happens, where they ship him off for a cruddy starting pitcher or something like that, and give him a fresh start for another team. Just given the way the Indians seem to operate, it would be very surprising to me to make the clubhouse decision to DFA him or something like that. And I don't know how well it would sit with him to move into a firm bench role, so that they could give somebody like, I don't know, Yandy Diaz a shot at third base or something like that. So it seems to me more likely that you could see him as part of another deal at the trade deadline to kind of just get him a fresh start somewhere. A clear path to playing time, but the Indians bring back somebody else on an unfortunate contract.
And just to clear up what I said about his contract, he doesn't have multiple years remaining. He's technically guaranteed about $15 million in 2019, and then there's a $2.5 million buyout for 2020. So do the math on that. He has, let's say, 7 plus 21.
17 million.
Something like $23 million, I believe, left on his. Excuse me, that's not right. No, he has $7 million or so remaining this season. Add that to about 15 next year, that's 22. So he has close to 25 million remaining in guarantees. So if you're looking around out there at starting pitchers with that kind of deal, or whomever, not quite sure off the top of my head, but I don't know, maybe they'll find something like you said, because that would make sense. Although I think they're probably more likely to try to let him work his way back. Because remember in the offseason when there was that Mets rumor that they would trade Kipnis for Paul Salom? And yet it was the Mets who crushed that. I thought that was a slam dunk for the Mets. And yet, maybe I was too optimistic about Kipnis
Well,
bouncing back.
what I have heard is that that deal was going to be made, and Mets ownership said no at the last minute, that the front offices had worked out the trade and that the Mets ownership quashed it.
Yeah.
So that if that's correct, then honestly, I don't know if that deal would have worked out any better for anybody involved. I mean, obviously Sewald would be an improvement for the Indians bullpen at this point, but I don't know. Maybe there's a kind of deal that could be worked out where the Indians go out and get a more expensive, who's actually a perfect fit for a deal here would be
I
sending
know.
Jason Kipnis to the Padres, where he could play second base for that team. I think that would be a really good fit, but they'd have to find a contract that would come back that would be equivalent. And you could see something with like the Brad Hand contract coming back the other way, and then the Indians giving up some substantial prospect depth to make the deal work.
that feels very complicated, and therefore I have to consider it very unlikely, because I don't think baseball teams like getting complicated any more than you and I like getting complicated, Brian. That's something you have to
But AJ Preller doesn't mind getting complicated.
I will concede that. He's going to break out all the Red Bulls in the world tonight and work this thing out. So we should do the same, except the opposite. And what I mean by that is we should probably wrap this thing up and not touch Red Bull, because I don't think it's good for your health, your mind, or your spirit, Brian. Do you agree?
Yeah, I'm not a Red Bull guy. Go drink some water.
Drink some water and breathe some oxygen. That's the way to a healthy, happy lifestyle.
Can you tell that Mr. Anderson on the other end has taken up running? It's a beautiful thing.
Yes, I have, and that's just beautiful is not usually the word I would use to describe my running. I would probably go with, you know, very how do I phrase this, Molina-like, perhaps even worse than Molina-like. But I try, and in the end, you know, trying is the important thing, because you'll never fail if you don't try. So that's a good lifestyle lesson for you kids listening out there. And that includes you, Sean Brody, who, again, is putting schoolwork ahead of talking nonsense. I can't even talk. Whatever. You know what? He just made a bad decision putting paper and books in front of us, is all I'm saying, Sean.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Remember what's really important in life, and that's talking about guys like Francisco Mejia on podcasts and definitely getting really deep into Boone Logan. When you, instead of learning calculus. So we got to question Sean's decision-making. I question anyone who's still listening to the show's decision-making as well, but I do appreciate you joining us. RJ, as always, thank you so much for being on the show and being the smart one of the two of us.
Yeah, I can't pronounce basic names, and I'm stumbling over very, very, let's say, elementary school vocabulary words right now. So I'm feeling very smart, very very healthy, very productive, and I just need a break, and I need to go, you know, do anything else at this point in order to recharge my batteries and make myself feel a little bit better about my awful performance today.
I think you're overselling it, but at the same time, we will let you guys go. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you sooner than you heard from us last time. Hopefully next week we will be in touch. But until then, take care.